It's my great pleasure to have on today the postdoc away, Dr. Laura Strong. Dr. Laura Strong got her PhD in organic chemistry from University of Wisconsin-Madison. She's currently serving several roles in the Madison community. One is a commission member on the Economic Workforce and Development Board. She's also a board member for the Organic Chemistry Advisory Board. And she's also a Merlin Mentor and co-chair for the Merlin Mentor Group. Most importantly, she is the president and chief operating officer of Quintessence Biosciences. And so she's going to tell us a little bit today about her transition from academia into the private sector and how she's kind of integrated herself in all these multiple roles and how she's become a very productive member of the Madison community. So welcome, Laura.
Thanks, Brian. I'm glad to talk to you today.
Okay. I'm very excited to have you on because you served kind of all these multifaceted roles within the community, and you did this essentially directly after you transitioned after your PhD from academia. So, to start off, if you can just kind of briefly summarize in kind of bullet point statements who you are and what your experience is, just some kind of taglines.
Sure. Well, I think I'm a scientist by education and an entrepreneur by immersion, and I think I dabble in a lot of other things that relate to how do you build things, whether it's people, companies, communities. So I would say that those are kind of my highlights, my taglines.
Okay. So it also seemed that I'm not exactly sure what your ultimate goal was, but you did move through the academic track. You got your bachelor's degree, and then you continued on and from undergraduate to graduate school, got your PhD. So what was it that motivated you to continue through this higher education pathway?
You know, I wish I could say it was something really profound, but I was in college doing my undergrad, and I took organic chemistry and fell in love with the ability to sort of learn this new language and be able to make things out of it. And in talking to my undergrad professors, they all said, you know, you should really go to grad school. I don't know that I really knew what that meant, other than it meant that I would continue to do organic chemistry, which was something, again, that I'd fallen in love with. So it sounded like a really good idea.
Okay. So were there any particular role models or influence, people that really influenced you as you were moving through, maybe your parents or family members, maybe a scientist or somebody that you met as you were transitioning through the academic path?
Well, it's interesting. So I actually never really wanted to be on the academic path. My father's a professor in business, though, not in science. And I never really sort of viewed myself as following that career track. So even when I came to graduate school, when I was interviewing at different graduate schools, contrary to the advice that I kept getting from people, I was very upfront that my goal really was to go into industry. So again, it's one of those things, I wish it were more profound, something, you know, that drew me to industry and applied science, but it's not quite as clear cut.
Okay, so did you have any mentors, I guess, in organic chemistry that really kind of lit a fire with your, kind of increased your passion for organic chemistry, and then, you know, maybe that played a role, I guess, in continuing on through your PhD? Because it sounded like maybe, I'm kind of fishing here, maybe you reached a point when you were in your undergraduate before you started graduate school that maybe you were unsure if you should maybe do an internship or just try to look for jobs, but instead you went the academic route. So I'm curious if there was maybe a course or an instructor or a mentor that you had that said, this is going to be, it's going to be what really works for you, it's going to make you really excited, and that kind of led you into your PhD.
Yeah, I was fortunate. I ended up for my undergrad at a small liberal arts college, University of Richmond, and you got a lot of kind of individual attention from folks because your class sizes were pretty small. So there were a couple of professors that were very involved in research, and they were really the ones who said, you know, if you really enjoy organic chemistry, you should go on to grad school. You know, you're smart enough to do it, and you'll really enjoy it. You know, again, this disconnect for me was I didn't really have any vision of where that would take me in terms of career per se, just the idea that, oh, I'll really enjoy it, and I'll get to continue doing research, and, you know, get to make cool molecules. And so, yeah, but I would definitely say the small environment and the professors that I had at University of Richmond were key in kind of, you know, pushing me along that path.
Okay. Now, how did you choose to come from your smaller liberal arts college to such a large research one institute like the University of Wisconsin-Madison? And moreover, how did you choose the particular lab that you ended up doing your graduate studies in?
So I came to UW-Madison really because it's top 10 in chemistry. It's top 10 in a lot of the different sciences. That's not necessarily something special if you're already here, but, you know, sort of from the outside, looking in, top 10 in chemistry, and particular in organic chemistry. And so it was high on the list of kind of, you know, interesting schools. And then when I came to visit actually in person, I had a great experience. So I met a couple of professors, Laura Kiesling, Dan Rich, who really used chemistry to kind of address biological problems. And that to me was very cool, this idea that, oh, I can not only make something, but I can make something and somebody's going to use it. That was really powerful. And so that was really what drew me to Wisconsin, was this ability to sort of make an impact with my chemistry.
Okay. And how did you choose your particular mentors, or your mentor, I guess, your advisor?
So when I got to Madison, you know, you sort of go through this process. I think Laura, I ended up in Laura Kiesling's mm-hmm. lab in the chemistry department. And I think that a big part of that was just her openness, her, you know, reception to this idea of, oh, you know, I want to go into industry. I don't necessarily want to follow the academic track. And, you know, I don't recall the conversations, but I don't remember that ever actually being
really
an issue.
Okay.
So, and I have to say it might be different now, but at that time, everybody kept saying, you've got to stop telling the professors that you want to go into industry. I was like, well, it's what I want to do. So, you know.
I'm kind of speaking now from a little bit more experience. I find that very impressive because of the idea that most academic professors would like to see their students and their trainees continue on in academia. So having that initial conversation with your professor in academia as you're doing research that you're funded through your NIH grants with, that you would like to transition into industry, is a very tough conversation. And I think you're probably one of the first people, if not the only person I've interacted with, that mentioned it was pretty much out in the open right from the get-go. It wasn't this aha moment that you were sitting at the bench saying, I cannot keep doing this repetitive experiments over and over without any, you know, kind of a product being produced, or without some kind of, you know, bigger goal at the end of the tunnel. So I find that very interesting. So it sounds like you immediately walked into Laura's lab, you had your rotation with her, and you told her, I'm interested in your research, but more importantly, I'm interested in actually getting a position in industry. And so maybe did that, if I understand correctly, did that set the tone for your few years in her lab?
I don't know if that set the tone for it, because I'm not sure that she treated me any differently than anybody else because of that.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say, you know, the research projects and all of that, nothing was, at least from my perception, nothing was different about
sure.
my path than the other people in her group.
Okay. That's also very impressive, because I think sometimes faculty may have the tendency to maybe push one person in a different direction, push one person in an alternative direction based on what their long-term interests are. And so I think one of the worries that I've had, that other people have had as they bring this up to their PI, is, you know, will you still get the really high impact important projects, or will you now, because you're not necessarily interested in kind of doing the small molecule or the smaller, you know, understanding and then building a bigger story and an academic path, will they just kind of set aside projects for you that, you know, are more like laboratory technician projects?
Hmm.
And I think talking to a lot of people, that's one of the biggest worries of how to actually bring that conversation up, because you still like to be productive in the lab. You would like to get a good letter of recommendation, but you don't want to be forced into a corner or eventually just told to leave the lab. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's starting, a lot of the information is now starting to come to light, and PIs are maybe picking up on this, is that not everybody's going to get the prize academic position. So I think some PIs are becoming more aware of the alternative opportunities out there and are trying to adjust their interaction with their students. But again, to come in right away and tell your PI in academia that you're interested in industry is very impressive.
I don't know that I fully appreciated the potential ramifications, other than I thought, I don't want to get part of the way down this road and then have to explain, why I suddenly, quote unquote, don't want to go into academia.
Sure.
But I have to say, I'm not sure that, part of the reason that maybe I kind of was thrown in with the rest of the crowd was because, we were all we all wanted to be high performers. So sure. We may have wanted, different outcomes in the end, mm-hmm. Different paths in the end, but we all really had this idea of we were going to come in here and light this place on fire by, whatever project it was that we were going to work on.
Okay.
So I think you had a lot of sort of maybe high intensity type A personalities coming together, and why treat them any differently?
Sure.
Let them all succeed if you can, I guess.
Okay, so that's still very impressive, both through the mentor's vision and also your vision, that you knew exactly what you wanted to do in the long term, that you didn't have this kind of scared moment of wanting to transition. So you had no desire at any point to continue on after your PhD and do a postdoc. That wasn't even an option in your head.
I was terrified by that option, and actually, it's funny to hear you sort of describe the potential transition to industry, because I actually had those similar feelings of, oh my gosh, what have I done? Am I going to spend my life doing this? But this was after about 3 years in the program, and I had learned how to make some molecules, and I was doing some really cool science, and I was interacting with some great biochemists who were using my molecules, and we were designing cool projects. And I realized that I was being trained to make molecules, and I was going to have to keep making molecules forever.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this was going to be my specialty, was making molecules, and I love it, but at the same time, I thought, I can't do this for the next 20 or 30 years of my life.
Sure.
What have I done? So that was kind of my what have I done moment,
mm-hmm.
was not industry versus academia, but actual hands-on bench science versus something else, which at the time, I had no idea what something else was.
So, this is going to lead into some of the other questions as we open up a little bit more. I'm curious, did you ever think about maybe taking on an internship within industry, or trying to do a volunteer fellowship, something, a co-op? I'm not sure what opportunities are presented in the accounts department. Had you looked into any of that just to make sure that you were making the right choice? Because the assumption is once you leave academia, it's very hard to come back. So I'm curious if you explored some of those options, or you knew.
I never questioned whether academia was the track for me.
Mm-hmm.
At the point at which I thought, I'm going to keep making molecules for the rest of my life, it was more about, do I want to get out of science?
Mm-hmm.
Do I want to go to business school? Should I go to law school? Should I, should I do something else that takes me into a different career other than hands-on science? But again, I had no idea. I didn't really have any idea what those careers looked like.
So you just decided to kind of forge your own path and kind of pick and choose what skill set, courses you wanted to take. I mean, that's a very noble yet very challenging, I think, an intimidating path to take, because a lot of people, in my opinion, a lot of people continue on through the academic pathway because it's just easy to transition on to that next step. You can always find a very welcoming arms. You can find a lot of professors that are willing to take you on as graduate for your graduate program and get your PhD. It's, in my opinion, it's also very easy to find a postdoc And so there's this idea that tunnel is kind of paved out very nicely for you. And I think as you're moving forward, sometimes that's the path of least resistance. So if you start kind of breaking against that and moving against the current, it's something you sometimes meet a lot more resistance. And I think people get very intimidated by that. It's not until maybe, again, you're maybe 3 or 4 years into your graduate program or into your postdoc that you realize it might be worthwhile to explore some of these options, because maybe you don't want to be sitting at the bench. Maybe you know, this repetitive behavior that you're starting to display in the lab, you want to branch out. You're starting to find more interest, branching points in business or in law or maybe in outreach. And again, I think that's very impressive that you kind of realized that early on and took action. I think that's, you know, it's very commendable.
Well, I'm not sure if I really identified it early on and took action. I think, you know, it's one of those things where you start to do things in life and you realize that there are parts of it you really like and parts of it you're not so wild about, and it's kind of this constant switching tracks to see if you can find more of what you like and less, sure, of what you don't like.
Sure.
Even if you don't necessarily know, you know, if the next step is necessarily going to take you there, mm-hmm, you sort of give it a shot and see, oh, I'm a little closer to where I want to be, or I'm a little farther than where I want to be. So I don't know that there was any grand plan,
okay,
that I was following.
Now, did you take any classes in business or in law while you were going for your PhD?
Not initially, but so I was interviewing for traditional chemist positions, mm-hmm, and going down that traditional road because I didn't really see kind of what else I could do. Mm-hmm. And I started talking to people about smaller companies that would need chemists, so biotech companies, and I didn't really know what that was about. You know, my sort of focus had been on pharmaceutical companies, being a chemist at a pharmaceutical company. But I started, again, kind of going down this path of these smaller companies, and people kept saying, well, if you go with a smaller company, they need, you know, 20 people and they only have 10. So if you're interested in something, as long as you're willing to work the extra hours, you can get exposure to a different part of the world, whether it's marketing or customer support or something. So I thought, you know, that actually sounds like a really good idea. You know, it's not like I haven't been working a lot, you know, for the grad school PhD thing. So, you know, more than 40 hours a week is not an issue. And I was talking with a variety of folks. I interviewed with some small companies. Then I talked actually to Laura Kiesling and Ron Raines on campus, who had been talking about starting a company. But both of them are, you know, obviously fantastic professors, and they wanted to remain in their academic, mm-hmm, positions. So we started these conversations about, well, I could start a company, and, you know, they could stay at the university. I know the science. We all know each other. And we decided that was a good idea. So towards the end of my PhD, I did take some classes at the Small Business Development Center, how to read financial statements, you know, all of these things, how to write a business plan, mm-hmm, all these things that I really didn't know anything about, and figured, you know, if we're going to start a company, then I gotta figure this stuff out. So
had you been aware of any of the business plan competitions through the business school or some of these other opportunities? Because, again, my impression now that I'm exploring a lot of these other options, unfortunately, kind of late in the game for me, is there are fantastic resources on the campus. It's just the communication and the speed at which one finds these opportunities is sometimes devastatingly slow, or it's at a very glacial pace that you start finding these things out. And sometimes it's unfortunate because maybe your goal early on was to get into the business world and maybe start your own company, and you feel, I've met people that are at least 10 years younger than me are starting their own companies with 3 or 4 people that are in these incubator spaces that are at, you know, 100 stage, or they have these, their programs in accelerator, or they've done these business plans throughout the United States, and they're just so ahead of the game. I'm curious if you took advantage of any of those opportunities.
So this was 13 years ago, and a lot of that stuff didn't really exist, okay, then. So I looked at the business school to see if I could take some classes, mm-hmm, formal classes through the business school, and that wasn't really a possibility given where I was in the school itself. So the Small Business Development Center really was sure. the only kind of place to go for that kind of thing. But I think you bring up a really good point, which is this question of the inefficiency of information transfer. I mean, there are so many things, and it's really hard to have some sort of catalog of kind of all of the different options mm-hmm. for what you could do or how you could help yourself get to where you want to go, or even how you can help yourself figure out where you want to sure. go. And with the proliferation of all of the programs that you talked about, the mm-hmm. business plan competitions and the classes and the incubators and the accelerators, you know, I think it makes it sometimes even more challenging than, you know, having just a couple of options, because you've almost got too many sure. options. You know, you have to explore them all and mm-hmm. you have to figure out which ones are the right ones. And so I think there's kind of a balance there.
Mm-hmm. So I'm very curious if you can elaborate a little bit more on this this interaction that you had with Dr. Ron Raines and Laura Kiesling to kind of develop what eventually became Quintessence Biosciences, because you mentioned early on your goal was not to sit at the bench, not to be in academia. And so it seemed as if maybe they were on board and you guys formed this trifecta of, you know, of collaboration, or everybody's in agreement with what's going to happen. And you mentioned they both wanted to stay at the bench. So was the natural progression for you to take over and kind of do everything on your own while they sat and
gave
guidance?
You know, if we're talking about the three of us, you know, so at the time that we formally started Quintessence, you know, Ron had a lab of 20 plus people mm-hmm. in biochemistry. Laura had a lab of 20 plus people in chemistry and biochemistry. Now they both have to join appointments. You know, so they both had pretty significant commitments mm-hmm. At the university. So, you know, when you're talking about division of labor, I think it, you know, it sort of makes sense that that I ended up doing, you know, a lot of the company business related things, because that's a tough ask for somebody who's mm-hmm. already got a more than full time job on sure. campus. So that was really, I look at it as that was my role, was sort of to bring this thing to life based on the discoveries that came out of their labs. And that was, again, kind of this idea of bringing it to life. I sort of envisioned, okay, we'll put the packaging around the science, and we'll write a business plan, and we'll get some money in, and we'll hire really experienced folks at doing this, and, you know, I just will have done something different, and it'll be cool. I'll learn a lot along the way. I'll meet some interesting people, and, you know, I don't have any idea what it means for me, but I'll end up with the experience to do something different
okay.
than what I'm trained to do at the end of my chemistry PhD.
Okay, so tell me more about Quintessence. I mean, it again, you mentioned that Ron Raines and Laura Kiesling were both part of kind of the early on technology, or early on patent, or the information, the ideas, I guess, that all kind of came together and became Quintessence. So, I mean, definitely explain what the company's mission is and what they're about.
Sure. Well, so the company today is a cancer drug development company. So our mission is to take our ribonuclease technology and convert that to an effective treatment for cancer patients. And early on, we licensed actually multiple technologies from the UW-Madison, from Wharf, and kind of worked through, exercised some of them. It's where I learned the lesson that not all great science can make great products, because you have to deal with a lot of things like intellectual property and cost of goods and those sorts of things. So over the years, we became this cancer drug development company, really okay. focused in on this ribonuclease technology, and we've taken that from early stage discovery to now treating cancer patients in a phase one clinical trial. So it's phase one of three mm-hmm. Trials to get FDA approval for a drug.
Okay. Now, how easy was it to make that transition? You mentioned you've been at this for quite a while. I assume the kind of the barrier for entry was fairly high, since you didn't have a lot of experience and maybe Ron Raines and Laura Kiesling weren't necessarily experienced in how to take this idea and move it into the business space. So I'm curious how long, I mean, did you envision how long it would take, and then maybe in theory how long it would take, and then actually how long it did take?
So looking back at the beginning of Quintessence, again, I didn't have this idea that I would be with the company for a long period of time, mm-hmm. or that I would really play any, you know, significant part in, I shouldn't say this, but I guess the company itself, because I just, you know, I thought, okay, you know, we'll raise this money and you know, we'll bring in these great people, and then I'll learn some things from them, and then I'll go off and do something mm-hmm. else. But we were really fortunate. So around the end of 2001, beginning of 2002, we were, again, very fortunate that we were looking for somebody with strong business experience. And at the time, a serial entrepreneur here in Madison named Ralph Cowton, who has a financial background but has been in biotech since the early days of Promega, he sold the company that he had founded and was looking for something, another opportunity. Mm-hmm. So we were able to connect with Ralph at the end of his last opportunity, and we recruited him to come to Quintessence. And that was really the first step in taking us from kind of some ideas and a little bit of funding to something more substantial. We raised additional equity financing. We built out our labs. We started working on translating the science into mm-hmm. products. And that was a really pivotal time for us.
Okay. So your position sounds like it may have changed, or at least morphed a little bit from when Quintessence first started to where you are now. So I'm curious if you can elaborate on that a little bit more, too, and how that transition affected maybe your work-life balance.
Since I've come to Quintessence, I've never actually done hands-on science at the company. So that part of it hasn't changed. In the initial days, I spent a lot of time writing business plans and, you know, developing product plans. And then as we started kind of building out the team, I spent more time kind of trying to manage projects and more of the strategic vision kinds of things. And I think eventually kind of grew into this situation where, you know, I was kind of looking at all of those next stage things and kind of helping keep people on track. And I think that's sort of how I ended up managing the operations mm-hmm. of the company. So I view it as kind of one of those things where you don't realize you're doing a job until somebody taps you on the shoulder and says, oh, you know.
You need to put a title to this now, right?
Right, right. So, you know, to me it was kind of this organic process, I guess.
Okay. So in the whole scheme of things, I guess, taking from, again, when Quintessence started to where you're at now, what are your day-to-day activities like? I mean, obviously they started off very different than where they are now in terms of getting the company started. So I'm just curious if you can elaborate a little bit more on that.
Yeah, so, you know, it's interesting. Every day is pretty much different, but every day is really interesting. So, well, I shouldn't say every day is interesting. Almost every day is interesting. You know, a lot of it is this idea of creating the vision, making sure that we're executing the things that we need to do in order to get to where we told our shareholders that we're going to get to. So, you know, a day in the life. A couple of weeks ago, I went down to Houston to MD Anderson to do a site visit for our phase one clinical trial. So I spent a lot of time looking at the data from the patients, you know, what kinds of things are we seeing in the patients, how does that inform our next decision about, you know, dose escalation or enrolling additional patients. But, you know, then I'm back, and right now we're working on an update to shareholders. So it's going back over the you know, last month or 6 weeks and saying, okay, what have we done? What do we need to tell shareholders about? Mm-hmm. And then you know, we also manage quite a few external contractors at this point who help us with our clinical trial. So ensuring that all of them are kind of working towards the same goal, that, you know, we're often the handoff point for a lot of things. Sure. So ensuring that this one is going to give me the information I need so I can hand it to that one, you know, in the same time frame that we think that's going to happen. So a lot of kind of being a conduit for information and keeping track of pieces of projects.
So how did you guys decide to keep the office here, the primary office of Quintessence here in Madison? And do you think that there's advantage or disadvantage based on the size of the city and maybe the size of the community in biotech?
So from the very beginning, Ron and Laura were committed to staying in Madison, and Ralph as well. So, you know, really for us, there was never this question of, are we going to pick up and move to the coast? This was definitely a, we're going to build it here company. And that's because Ron, Laura, Ralph are all very committed to the community.
Okay.
And so that did create some interesting features. So we're a drug development company. We've raised about $18 million in equity financing to support our work. It is, I would say, atypical to raise that amount of money from individual investors, right, which is what we've done. Mm-hmm. And we've done that primarily, or in large part, because Madison, or Wisconsin in general, doesn't have a plethora of right. venture capital. So if you want to raise money, if you want to do this kind of thing, you have to look for the alternatives. And that's angel investment, that's SBIR grants, small business grants via the federal government. And you really have to sort of go down this different path, because the sort of traditional coastal path is not possible really here in Madison.
So you seem, I think maybe something else that plays a big role, you seem very well connected within the community, and you seem to know a lot of the different players here, and I think that may help increase the exposure of your company, increase the awareness of what Quintessence does. And so how important do you feel, besides just site visits and interacting with investors, how important do you feel it is to network with people within your community so that they may be able to act as somewhat of a conduit in helping you find either investment opportunities or help you find a CEO, help you find other people that maybe your company needs to interact with? Because again, I believe one of the advantages of this community is that it's fairly small and it's relatively tight-knit for the biotech community and the high-tech community. So I'm curious if you would also agree, if you guys have taken advantage of that.
Yeah, so, you know, I mentioned Ralph's background from the early days of Promega, and so he's been involved in Promega, Panvera, Miris. He's on the board of other biotech companies. He is a mentor to a number of folks. He's on the board of First Business Bank. So he's very actively involved in the community. And one of the great things for me is that he's encouraged me to also be active in the community. And I think that that does lead to a lot of folks knowing, you know, who we are, what we do as a company, and I think that that does benefit us, certainly. We've also worked very hard to try and make connections in the community. If you're going to raise $18 million from individuals, you really, you know, you're going to have to make a lot of
right.
pitches in order to bring that kind of support together. And so we've done quite a bit of outreach, particularly when we're in a fundraising round, looking for funding. And so I think that's really contributed to that sense of kind of knowledge in the community as well.
Okay. So tell me about some of the other roles that you serve, because again, your experience and your current, I guess, advisories/board roles you serve on, I assume that came with, you know, your interest or maybe recommendations from the community that you serve on these boards. So I'm curious if you can talk a little bit more about those roles.
Sure. Well, it's interesting. Often these things come about with people approaching me about doing something that I may not have anticipated doing. so one of the initial things that happened was I got asked to join the board of BioForward a number of years ago, and so that is also one of the kind of community outreach or kind of knowledge things, connections, I guess I should say. And so I built a lot of connections through that experience. And then I started participating in a group called Merlin Mentors, which is a lot of fun. I think initially when I was approached, I thought, gosh, I'm still in the midst of my own thing. I'm not sure that I'm necessarily the right person to be helping somebody be an entrepreneur when I'm still trying to figure it out myself. But I think, you know, you're always kind of working on how to be a better business owner. So that's actually been a fantastic experience. I've learned quite a bit about myself and my own leadership styles and capabilities from trying to help other entrepreneurs sort of become the best that they can be. And in that program, they basically try and match existing entrepreneurs in the community with people who are looking to or have launched businesses. And the goal isn't to help them build their company necessarily. It's really to help the entrepreneurs become better entrepreneurs. And maybe this company doesn't work, but the next one, you know, has a better shot because they're a better entrepreneur.
Sure.
So that's a fantastic, for me, has been a fantastic experience. The Dane County Economic and Workforce Development Commission you mentioned earlier, it's one of these things when you start to understand how businesses grow and the interaction with government and how that can positively or negatively impact a business, you don't quite realize that there's a lot of overlap there. So that's been an interesting experience to kind of broaden my horizons on how, for example, the workforce development efforts in the state of Wisconsin really can help to impact, you know, biotech businesses. So, for example, or I'll use an example from, I guess, the tech world. You know, one of the things that folks are really looking to do now, or local companies, they're looking for software developers. Mm-hmm. And that talent pool, you know, it's fairly substantial in town, but it seems like there's more demand than there is supply. So that's an area where, you know, if there are training programs, if there are, you know, things that could be done at Madison College or something like that, you know, that's where you sort of have to try and find the ties back to either, you know, city or local government, or, you know, the universities or college systems, and figure out how do we get more qualified workforce, because these businesses are growing here in Madison.
Right. I completely agree with that. On a side note, personal note, that's exactly something I've noticed, is that there's quite a need for web developers. So Madison Area Technical College does offer web development, programming, different languages. So that's something I'm exploring, because it's very obvious. It's very obvious that the demand is very high here. So I'm curious. Also, you have all these different roles. You have, you kind of interact with multiple individuals, and traditionally, most people see academic scientists or academics coming out of, you know, the university as not being very extroverted, not being very good at communicating, and just maybe they're good at talking about their science, but it seems that you've been able to kind of communicate across disciplines and be very good at leading groups in business and groups in science. So I'm curious, do you think that was a skill that you picked up as a PhD, or that's something you learned along the way, or did you realize this was something early on you needed to focus on and you worked to get better at?
I guess I would say that it's something that I work hard on probably every day. I think this is one of the ways that in science we sometimes sell ourselves short, because you can be doing the coolest, most impactful science in the world, and unless you can communicate it to another group of scientists whose help you may need, or somebody who has funding for, you know, the product that may come out of this, or the person who you need to participate in a clinical trial so you can get your drug to market, or, you know, you could go down the list. Unless you can communicate the value of what you're doing to those people, the impact of what you're doing to those people, you really are selling yourself short. You're not able to convey why what you're doing is important. So I think communication about science is really important to me. And again, it's kind of across all of those facets, to people who know all the details, or maybe people who are trained in a different discipline and you need their buy-in. But yeah, I think that is really important to me. I'm not sure that I would use the word extroverted to refer to myself, but certainly I see the value mm-hmm. of being able to do that. And again, it's something that I try and work on a lot.
Yeah, sure. I mean, extroverted in respect that, or in terms of, you know, you're willing to talk to somebody that you may not know. Or you're willing to interact with somebody and talk about something that you may not be an expert on. I think that's sometimes a big disconnect that a lot of scientists have a tough time with, because you go to national conferences, you kind of watch bubbles form of people that are really good at, you know, studying particular signaling pathway and cancer cancer signaling pathway, or people that study ion channels, or people that only study one protein that's important for maintaining rhythmicity of cardiac tissue. So I think to try to get people talking across disciplines is very important, but not just across disciplines, but also with people that, you know, you may have never interacted with before and may know nothing about the research. I think that's very important, especially for folks that want to transition from academia into, you know, the business world. As you mentioned, trying to sell the value of what your research is, or what your story is, or what your business mission is, I think is really important in that. And that's only going to come through very eloquent conversation and communication with people. So it seems that you, if I'm guessing correctly here, you thrive in kind of a, I don't want to say hectic environment, but you have your hands in a lot of different areas. And so I'm assuming that this may be something you really enjoy, because again, going back to one of your original points, you may not have enjoyed the repetitive nature of what you're doing in the lab, and so here you're getting to kind of dip your hands in a lot of different opportunities. So would you say that's something you thrive in generally?
I would say that I love to learn, and so a lot of it comes from having some curiosity about something, about how something works. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll take economic development as kind of an example. So if you had asked me a few years ago, what is economic development, and, you know, what does it really mean, I would have probably said something to you like, I'm not really sure, because businesses are the ones that, you know, they're the ones that are doing the economic development. They're the ones that have the companies and the products and the employees. But when, you know, you start to learn more about it and you listen to people talking about, you know, infill and density, and, you know, you start saying, well, what in the world is that? Well, then you start to realize, okay, well, the way that a city like Madison is able to thrive and have a good school system or have good roads is the tax base. And where does the tax base come from? The tax base comes from, you know, property taxes from homeowners mm-hmm. and business taxes. And so you've got to have really good businesses in your community that are very strong in order to pay the taxes to have the good schools and the good roads. And so you start to see, like, okay, there's an ecosystem here, and all of these pieces need to fit together. So we really, you know, we need to not only encourage business, but we also need to make sure that we've got good quality of life, because your employees sure. want to be able to send their kids here. To the good school, you know. So, you know, it's learning more about all of these different things is really interesting.
Okay. So I've got two other questions for you, and these are probably going to be the most important. So I think your experience would allow you to answer these pretty well. So what would you say is the value of having a PhD? Somebody, again, somebody with your experience and all the opportunities that you've been able to take advantage of, would you directly relate that to your experience as a PhD, or would you say that this is something maybe tangential to your experience as a PhD? I mean, in either way, what would you say moving forward through your graduate career was the most, the biggest take-home message, the biggest advantage of doing a PhD? How would you sell somebody on getting a PhD is my question.
You know, I would say my usual knee-jerk reaction or my knee-jerk answer to that question is, you know, the value of a PhD is really learning problem-solving skills. But if you come at it from kind of a business, more business orientation, you know, the goal of getting your PhD really is getting that PhD. So how are you going to do that? It's by going in, finding a really interesting question to ask, mm-hmm. and collecting a lot of information so you do your best to actually answer that question. And then you communicate that to people in your thesis, and that's, you know, verbally in your defense and also, you know, written in the final report. So there's a ton of project management, communication skills. So it's not necessarily just about the problem solving, but there are all these other components of, if you use this as an opportunity to manage a very important project in your life, because it's, you know, it's not only the five or however many years of actually getting the degree, but it's the opportunity cost of the things that you could have been doing with that time, yes, in your life. So it's a very important project, and looking at it as a way to sort of train yourself to do very large projects and accomplish something, you know, quite massive, I think is a good way to look at it.
Okay. It's a great answer. Now, imagine you have all this experience and you have the opportunity to go back and take a position in academia. And as a mentor, as an advisor, somebody walks into you, into your lab and asks, you know, tell me about, you know, career options. Tell me why I should enter this program, and tell me, you know, if I want to follow in your path, what are the steps for success, or what would get me on track to be somebody just like you? If you had the opportunity to go back into academia and tell some of these kids that are looking to get their PhD, that want to make a transition out and follow a path similar to yours, what would you go back and advise them to do?
Well, I would say, first, my career path has not... It's not a straightforward one, and I think it would be incredibly difficult to replicate, only because there were a lot of sort of twists of fate and things that happened that all really needed to happen for me to end up where I am. So I don't know that that's necessarily a good goal to follow this path, but I would say that sort of taking hold of your PhD as your own, and saying, you know, I have an advisor and that's great. I have a mentor and that's wonderful. Those people can help me, but I need to decide what I want to end up with in the end. I need to decide that, you know, I want good communication skills. I want to have good, clear project management skills. You know, I want to be able to demonstrate that I have not only a knowledge of, say, carbohydrate chemistry, but organometallic chemistry and polymer chemistry as well, you know, different disciplines that you want to learn. I want to demonstrate leadership capabilities, and so I need to have a multidisciplinary project.
Sure.
You know, think about those things that you want to build as your own skill set, and how do you go about creating a PhD experience where you can do those things? And of course, you need help. You need mentors. You need the support of the department and all of those kinds of things. But I think this idea of coming into a graduate school program as kind of a passive participant, mm-hmm. is one of the issues that creates this feeling at the end of, well, now what the heck am I going to do? You know, which I have to say is sort of how I ended up. Sure. Like, what? wait, what did I just do? And so kind of coming at it with this idea of this is what I want this experience to create for me. This is the value I want to walk away with. I think can help people get on the path to a career doing a lot of different things, not just, you know, what I do, but I think it would open the door to a lot of different experiences.
Yeah. That's, again, great advice. So I again want to thank you for going through the interview with me. And can you tell us the easiest way to find you online? I've also have to add some side commentary that Laura's quite the social media expert. I think she can put a hashtag in front of anything, and she knows all the handles that one would need for Twitter. So what's the easiest way to find you online and to interact with you?
Probably the most interactive way is on Twitter, and I go by the handle at @CienTre, @CienTre. So that's probably the easiest way to track me down.
Okay. And you will be at the BioForward Bioscience Vision Summit.
I will.
So if anybody had any questions, that will be here in the Madison area, I think September 18th. Laura will be around. And again, I want to thank her for going through this interview process, and I look forward to interacting with you in the future.
Sounds great.
Thanks, Laura.
Thanks, Brian.